Welcome to LabCorp Perspectives Oncology, where we'll connect on cancer, science, and patient care. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Previs, and I'm a Director of Medical Affairs here at LabCorp. I'm so excited to have my colleague, Sarah Young, join me today. Thanks so much, Sarah, for being here.
Thanks, Becca, for having me. So yeah, I'm Sarah. I am a genetic counselor by training here at LabCorp, and I'm a clinical program manager for oncology. I came to LabCorp via the Invitae acquisition, where I'd been at Invitae for about 5 years. And prior to that, I was at the University of Chicago for about 9 years, where I helped start a high-risk prostate cancer clinic. So that's where my interest in prostate and urologic cancers began. And I've been lucky to continue that work here at Invitae and LabCorp. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much again for joining us. And urologic oncology is the topic that, you know, we would love to talk about more today. And so you recently attended the American Urologic Association conference, where I know that you helped plan a panel discussion on genetic testing in urologic oncology. So for our listeners, can you give us an overview of the topics that were covered and really why is this such an important topic right now?
Sure. Yeah. So this was a really exciting session. It was actually the first time that genetic testing was the focus of a plenary at AUA. The impetus for this session is really the increasing evidence and support for expanded germline and somatic testing for really cancer treatment and management in general, but particularly for prostate cancer, where results can guide FDA-approved targeted therapies like PARP inhibitors. So the panel discussed genetic testing for prostate, bladder, and kidney cancer. A key discussion point was what we call universal germline genetic testing, meaning testing for all patients, particularly prostate cancer patients, regardless of risk factors like age, family history, or disease stage. This approach has been gaining traction, particularly as there are certain studies, one that we led in prostate cancer, that have shown restrictive testing criteria can miss patients with actionable variants.
And you and I talk about this concept of universal germline testing all of the time on our mutual team. So, you know, I think this is a really timely topic, and I'd love to hear from your perspective. You know, what are some of the biggest knowledge gaps or misconceptions that came up during the panel discussion?
Sure. So I think a common misconception, particularly in prostate cancer, is that germline variants are really only found or are relevant for advanced or metastatic disease. That's kind of where the studies originated. But more recent studies show that these variants are actually pretty common across different disease stages. So up to 20% or 1 in 5 patients with prostate cancer will carry one of these inherited germline mutations. So I think that we're trying to really dispel the myth that germline testing is this exceptional tool that is only used in rare cases where there's multiple generations of cancer. In reality, it's becoming a standard of care tool for many cancers, including prostate cancer. And it's really not just about familial risk. We know that germline testing can also now, in the age of precision medicine, precision oncology, can directly inform treatment decisions and, again, qualify patients for these targeted therapies.
Yeah, that 20% number really sticks out in my mind as being so critically important. You know, and we certainly wouldn't want to miss one of these patients, especially if there's an option to, you know, test other family members or even think about a targeted therapy. You know, that brings up my next point. One of the fundamental aspects to really our discussion is this difference between both somatic as well as germline testing. So why don't you summarize for us, you know, what are the key differences? Why are both so necessary? And I would argue complementary for patient care.
Yeah, that's what I was going to emphasize. Both are important. They're just different types of tests looking for different types of variants. So at a basic level, somatic testing is looking for these acquired variants that occur in this case in the tumor. And so we're looking for variants that are driving that cancer that can be used for targeted therapy. And typically, this testing is done on tumor tissue, which is the gold standard for somatic testing. But more recently, what's gaining traction is doing testing on blood, looking at these variants in circulating tumor DNA. Contrary to that, germline testing is looking for inherited mutations that are present in all cells. Therefore, they can be passed on to offspring. And again, they can impact both treatment decisions and hereditary cancer risk. But like you said, both tests are really critical, particularly in prostate cancer, because germline and somatic variants in what we call homologous recombination repair, or HRR genes, are what determine eligibility for these PARP inhibitors.
Yeah, you're right. And somatic cancer care testing on the tissue or liquid, you know, really helps guide our oncologists for targeted therapies like PARP inhibitors, which you mentioned. But, you know, every test has its limitations. Somatic testing can certainly miss those germline variants. And so, you know, can you explain for us why that happens? What are some of the implications of that missed variant?
Yeah, so we know that 6 to 20% of germline variants are missed if we're doing tumor-only sequencing. There's a study of advanced prostate cancer where 20% of these actionable variants, ones in the HRR genes, were undetected if we did somatic testing alone. So the tests are done on different platforms where they're interrogating different genes at different levels of detection. So somatic tests don't always sequence deeply enough to find all the relevant germline variants, such as variants in non-coding regions or certain complex rearrangements. And additionally, somatic labs will often filter out germline variants because they would like a more pure somatic result.
No, that totally makes sense. And, you know, back to this idea of universal germline testing, which we really started with, you know, I know that there's growing evidence in this area. Your team has really supported a lot of trials behind that. But, you know, one study in particular that comes to mind is the PROCLAIM study. Why don't you share with us kind of the findings from that and the latest data around universal germline testing?
Sure. So the PROCLAIM trial was a study of about 1,000 unselected. So by that, we mean testing in this universal manner. And these were prostate cancer patients, primarily from community urology practices, which is important because we know that's where the majority of cancer care is taking place. These patients were tested with large multi-gene cancer panels, and by design, we had about half of patients that met NCCN testing criteria and half that didn't. Overall, we found 7.7% of all prostate cancer patients had one of these germline pathogenic germline variants. And most importantly, there was no significant difference between those who met NCCN criteria, where that rate was 8.8%, and those who didn't, where it was 6.6%. So this just suggests that the current guidelines are too restrictive. We did a follow-up study from this cohort where we looked at clinician-reported outcomes, and we saw that 20% of patients had a treatment change and 64% of patients had a change in their follow-up care based directly on these genetic testing results, which really just emphasizes the clinical utility of testing.
And you've really been telling kind of a story here. I want to call out then that follow-up commentary that you and the team published that, again, kind of in my mind summarizes why this just makes so much sense and advocates for universal testing for these patients.
Yeah, we're particularly proud of this commentary we published in JCO Oncology Practice. It was along with 25 urology experts. And I think it really speaks to, you know, how we're changing hearts and minds in the field. People are getting behind this notion of germline genetic testing and pretty, you know, passionately. And a point we make in the paper is that there's various professional societies that allow consideration of or recommendation for germline, universal germline genetic testing for really every other common hereditary cancer. So that would be breast, ovarian, colorectal, now endometrial. So we really feel that prostate cancer should not be an exception.
Okay, Sarah, I love that you mentioned hearts and minds, but you and I both know that we're evidence-based, we're data-driven. And despite all of this that you bring up, germline testing still remains underutilized. So can you call out for us some of the biggest barriers that really are preventing that wider adoption?
Yeah, so just to your point, we know that germline testing across the board is underutilized, but particularly in prostate cancer, a recent study showed that only 1% of all prostate cancer patients were getting germline testing. That rate increases to about 13 to 30% when we're looking at patients with metastatic disease where it's universally recommended. But even that, you know, is certainly way below the 100% adoption we'd hope for. So there certainly are cited barriers to incorporation of germline testing. And we'll talk about some of these solutions in a bit too, but just to kind of state those barriers. A big one is knowledge gaps for providers. So in particular, urologists often feel unprepared to discuss genetic testing. You know, they weren't part of this hereditary breast ovarian cancer wave. They're a little bit later to the game. Only about 4% of urologists say that they have formal genetics training. Also, complex testing guidelines. So we know there's different nuances between different societies' guidelines like NCCN and AUA. And most importantly, for patients with localized disease, these criteria often require knowing a pretty in-depth family history. Certainly, a busy urologist is not going to have time to take a three-generation pedigree in practice. And also, patients just don't often know their family history or have small, uninformative families. Another limitation is clinical workflow challenges. So certainly, you know, efficient ways to incorporate this into their daily practice. Limited access to genetic counselors. There are certainly never going to be enough genetics experts to accommodate all the patients that need testing. And lastly, cost or insurance concerns. So while testing costs have dropped, certainly we need better coverage. We need insurance to actually start adopting these broader testing guidelines.
Yeah, but I would point out all of these barriers are not, you know, insurmountable, right? I think we're uniquely positioned as a reference lab where we have, you know, tests for both germline and somatic, and perhaps we're uniquely positioned to offer solutions. So let's think about, you know, what are some of the ways that we can overcome these challenges in the real world?
Yeah, so I think a big thing is improving education and coming up with novel ideas for incorporating genetic testing into routine practice. In terms of education and provider education, you know, this could start as early as residency training, incorporating genetics training into residency and fellowship programs. There's also been a lot of web-based tools that have been designed for clinician education, certainly podcasts where, you know, people that are busy can get this information on the go. And also professional societies have a lot of educational initiatives that providers can take advantage of. But in terms of actually incorporating this into practice, there has been a lot of work done in prostate cancer. Again, because, you know, we've been later adopters to genetic testing, it's allowed us to try out different ways of getting this testing done. So things like doing pre-test videos or telehealth models can help streamline the genetic information getting delivered to patients. And particularly expanding genetic services at the point of care. So this is what we refer to as mainstream testing, where the patient's care team is actually the one ordering the testing rather than a genetics provider. This has been shown to be extremely effective and very acceptable to patients. They appreciate they can do it at their normal clinic visit. It's being done by providers that they know and that they trust. So I really think we're kind of shifting in that direction. Where we as a lab can help is that we can offer post-test genetic counseling. So if a provider is not comfortable explaining results, particularly complex or positive results to a patient, that's where genetic counselors, whether they're local or, again, housed at the laboratory, can step in. And our laboratories also provide pretty in-depth next steps guides. So once the provider gets that result, it kind of breaks down what the result means, what the associated cancer risks are, what the next steps for management are. So yeah, to your point, I think this is not insurmountable. There's a lot of work that's been done. It just takes, you know, providers taking that leap and you know, seeing what would work for them in their practice.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to pull a little bit on that thread of this concept of mainstreaming this type of work. You know, because we do know that from data and the literature that there are patient populations where they're at higher risk of being overlooked for germline testing. Can you tell us a little bit more about these populations and ways we can overcome that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the goals of broadening testing is making sure we're not missing any patients. Particularly in prostate cancer, we know that Black or African American patients are disproportionately affected with prostate cancer, particularly advanced disease. And it's often these patients that are being missed with genetic testing. Particularly in the PROCLAIM study, we saw that Black patients who didn't meet NCCN criteria actually had higher rates of these germline variants than patients who met criteria. So this, again, just highlights the testing guidelines are not sensitive enough. They're, you know, they were developed based on studies that were predominantly in white or European populations, and they're often missing patients with more diverse backgrounds.
And this has clinical implications, right? You know, we talk a lot about clinical utility, and we've mentioned PARP inhibitors a little bit earlier, which are now approved for patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. But eligibility of patients for these types of targeted therapies depends on the findings that, you know, are uncovered by one of these assays. You know, let's highlight for our listeners the key genes that are important and really could, you know, lead to a targeted therapy.
Sure. So the genes that people are probably most familiar with are the BRCA1 and 2 genes. And, you know, although they're the breast cancer genes, they're certainly very relevant in prostate cancer. Actually, BRCA2 is the most prominent gene in prostate cancer and particularly is associated with more aggressive disease. In turn, it's actually the gene that shows the strongest response to PARP inhibitors. But there's actually other homologous recombination repair genes that can qualify patients for these targeted therapies. So I think prostate cancer actually has the kind of the longest list or longest tail of these other qualifying genes. So these would be genes like, of course, BRCA1, but also genes like ATM or CHET2 or POLB2, all of these can influence response to therapy. Certainly, we know the most about BRCA1 and 2, but we're learning more about how these other genes respond. And again, it's both somatic and germline mutations that can qualify patients for these therapies. And we've seen actually exceptional responses in patients who have both a germline and a somatic variant, or where we can prove that the germline variant is what's actually driving the cancer. And I'd be remiss to not mention the mismatch repair genes. These are a set of genes that predispose to a hereditary colorectal cancer syndrome called Lynch syndrome. But when we find deficiencies in these genes in the tumor, they actually can qualify patients for a different type of targeted therapy, which is called an immune checkpoint inhibitor or pembrolizumab. And we know prostate cancer patients, although they're less likely to have these variants, when they have them, they respond really well to this sort of treatment.
Yeah, and that's really exciting. Checkpoint blockade and checkpoint inhibitors have been a game changer in precision oncology space for some time now, you know, and that kind of brings me up to one of my last points is, you know, this is an area where there's so much emerging research and evidence. You know, how can this emerging data that's ongoing in clinical trials right now, you know, expand the role of genetic testing in prostate cancer in the future?
Yeah, so I think the idea is that the sooner you have this genetic information, you know, the more you can provide anticipatory guidance on that patient's journey for disease. So if they were to progress, you have that information in hand earlier. This is particularly important because we know that PARP inhibitors are moving to earlier stages in treatment. So clinical trials now are looking at PARP inhibitors in the hormone sensitive stage or even the neoadjuvant setting. And research is also exploring how variants can influence treatment response beyond PARP inhibitors. So particular variants can make patients respond better to radium-223, which is a common therapy for prostate cancer, as well as platinum-based chemotherapy, or the opposite. So certain mutations like BRCA2 may actually correlate with worse outcomes, particularly on androgen deprivation therapy alone, which is, again, a very common therapy for prostate cancer. And then on the very other end of the spectrum, you have studies like an NIH-funded study that's looking at germline-driven screening strategies. So patients who don't have prostate cancer yet, but how should we best screen them when we know that they're at higher risk?
Yeah, that's such an exciting space. I know there are lots of future directions. Well, I think we're almost out of time. Any final key takeaways that you'd like to share on the future of, you know, testing in urologic oncology with our listeners?
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, the field's evolving really rapidly. I think at this point, genetic testing really should be viewed as not optional. It's no longer this exceptional test. It's something that's essential for prostate cancer management, treatment selection, hereditary risk assessment. And this concept of universal germline testing has strong clinical justification. In order to implement it, certainly we need to provide additional education to providers. We need to streamline workflows, improve insurance coverage. All of that will lead to broader adoption, but we've already, you know, made good progress, and there's a lot more we can do.
Well, I just want to thank you so much, Sarah, for being such a great colleague and leader in this space. I know I certainly learned something in chatting with you today, and I want to thank our listeners for joining in. We hope that you'll join us next time as we talk more about science, cancer, and patient care on LabCorp Perspectives Oncology.
Thanks so much.
Have a good one.